Erlem Sports.
Hello and welcome to the Verulam Sport Podcast. Every week, the team behind the award-winning Radio Verulam Sports Show will provide you with the most relevant news from the local and regional sporting scenes, whilst keeping you in the picture with national and international bulletins from the world of sport. There will be topical debates, regular interviews from local talent, and chats with those big-name guests that are a mainstay of Verulam Sport. As always, this is your show, every bit as much as it is ours. So, check out Verulam Sport across social media and get involved. For now, prepare yourself for this week's action-packed Verulam Sport Podcast. Hello and welcome once again to Verulam Sport Podcasting. And I tell you what, I tell it to you every week, it's the highlight of my personal week. And I know secretly, deep down inside, it's yours too. And welcome again to Verulam Sport Podcasting. And as I say, I love a good sporting debate. It's one of my favourite things to do on planet Earth. It's why I feel very privileged to be here on Verulam Sport Podcasting doing what we do. But I think this could well have been one of the most challenging debates that we've ever set ourselves. This week, we are going to be unpacking what we're calling the Mount Rushmore sport. Mount Rushmore, for the uninitiated, I know you know it, come on, you do, but it is a colossal sculpture carved into the granite face of Mount Rushmore in the Black Hills, Keystone, South Dakota. Featuring and immortalizing for all eternity in 60-foot profiles, the U.S. presidents George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Theodore Roosevelt, and Abraham Lincoln. They represent America's birth, growth, development, and preservation. And we're following suit, but we're doing it for sports stars all time. But look at that. Just four faces. Today we are enshrining and immortalizing our Mount Rushmore of all-time sports stars, giants of their fields, who transcended their sport and era to be something infinitely greater. A permanent reminder of the power through sport to inspire, uplift, and change us all. But this is pan sport, all time, and the debate for a Mount Rushmore of any sport will be challenging and indeed controversial. So we're doing that and we're amplifying it because we're taking Verulam Sport seriously. The sport is the key word. So we've got but four to play with, and no, on this one, like everything else, you've got your own opinions. Who should feature? Who are we not going to include? What giants of their sport would make your Mount Rushmore? All-time sport, get involved. Keep the machine busy. Tweet us at Verulam Sport. Ideally, embrace it, love it. Great to hear from you. And I simply know on this one, you're awash with opinions and answers in your Mount Rushmores of sport. And before we get enshrining, before we kick things off, I'm going to invite to the show the legendary machine, Jason McKenna, to give us just a little bit of the hectic, exciting updates we've been receiving in swathes across social media for this challenging, compelling debate. Who's making the listeners Mount Rushmore of sport, Jason?
Well, Tony, you've introduced it, and it has been a really difficult decision for me and obviously for the listeners as well, because many a name have been thrown into there. And I think the sad thing as well for me is that there's so many in there that I feel could possibly should be in there. But obviously you and I have both made two choices each. It was so hard. But Angus has come in here and he said, without doubt, my four have to be Ali, Pele, Jordan and Woods. And very admirable selections there. Mary has said Serena Williams has to be a consideration. She's so inspiring. Rory has said Michael Phelps, the most decorated Olympian of all time. He has to be there as the Olympics are the pinnacle of sport. And that is a very good argument there. Michael has come in with what I think is a really fun one. He said Babe Ruth, but also Joe DiMaggio for giving us the great line in the Simon and Garfunkel song. And then Tina has said Michael Schumacher and Usain Bolt, both for being the fastest people around. So I think those are really good selections there. And spoiler alert, I don't think any of them have made it in apart from maybe one. But we shall see who comes into that mix a little bit later there, Tony. But yes, who do you like from that selection there, Tony? And maybe who is your first selection?
You know what, Jason? I love them all. I think Tiger Woods is a great one, but I would argue, and this is where it gets fascinating, I would argue if he makes certainly, he doesn't make ours, just to let you guys know. I undernarmed about Tiger, but I don't know if he would be there over Nicholas in golf. If there was going to be one representative of golf, Nicholas, of course, I'm just going to spoil or tease, as it were, and say that both of my two were in the shortlist of six, the 1999 BBC Sports Personality of the Century. And Nicholas was another one in that mix. Tiger didn't make that particular shortlist. And of course, that 99 era was right at the peak of Tiger's powers. I'm not saying that the BBC Sports team are the fount of all sporting knowledge. I do respect them massively. But I think that list is a very compelling one. And indeed, two of mine will be featured on that shortlist. So great shout there. I love the Phelps shout, as it was made very clear there, brilliantly deconstructed. The Olympics is the zenith of all sports, really, is the granddaddy of them all. It's the most watched sporting event on planet Earth, and all sports unite. And, you know, again, that one that I love to use, the winningest. You look who tops that list. It's the great swimmer from the States, Michael Phelps. Certainly could make a very, very compelling case to have his face in the Mount Rushmore of sport. But like I say, any sport, cricket, golf, tennis, any sport you care to mention, track and field, if you're only going to choose from four from a singular sport, it's going to get controversial. Because the beauty of it is that it's great to debate and we love it, but you're going to almost be coming down to so many subjective matters, because comparing eras, you can deconstruct the stats and the facts and you can understand the historicity and the sociological aspects all you like. But there are too many unknowables to make it an objective decision. And so it just becomes down to who do I most connect to? Who resonates with me? And, you know, that's why I love this debate. But I got to tell you, it is one of the most challenging ones. I had a lot of thought and a lot of kind of scratching people off my particular list as I had to sacrifice it down to two. Finally, before I unleash my very first, coming back to that awesome bit of social media engagement, I really like the Serena Williams shout. And I want to give her massive, massive respect. Jason, as we always do, we love to praise the development, the grace and the greatness of female sports. For all too long, there have been glass windows. We are certainly not at level equality. But my goodness me, that Serena Williams shout, for the way in which she has marched almost inexorably, just needs one more to be the winningest female Grand Slam winner all time. Got a chance, I think, coming up at the US Open. But there we go. That was a wonderful shout. I think some great social media engagement. And I know it's going to keep coming because I know this is a challenge. I know this one is super controversial. I also know you've got all the answers. You've got your four, and they are the four. So keep them coming. Tweet at Verum Sport. We love to hear from you. But right now, without any further ado, I'm going to introduce the first name on my Mount Rushmore of all-time sport. As I mentioned already, he was in the shortlist of six to be in contention for BBC Sports Personality, not of a year, not of the decade, but of the 20th century. You may know the name Jesse Owens. Born September the 2nd, 1913, till March the 31st, 1980, James Cleveland Owens had a career in which he took the athletic world by storm. This is phenomenal, Jason. Just take a seat for this. Before we build up, of course, to his Olympian time, before that, a year earlier, 1935, he set three world records and tied another in an hour, actually within 45 minutes. It was at a Big Ten track meet in Ann Arbor, Michigan. This feat has never been recreated. And given the nature of our world in which we're aware of the need for rest, of maybe even the dangers of putting the body through such endeavors in such an unbelievably short amount of time, I truly don't think that this will ever be replicated. It was referred to in Sports Illustrated as the greatest 45 minutes in sports. And who could argue with that? Owens ranked sixth in an ESPN list of the greatest U.S. sports stars of the 20th century, in which, from the world of track and field, he was the highest placed. As I've already mentioned, he was on that short list for the BBC Sports Personality of the Century. Jesse Owens, the youngest of 10 children, he would attribute his athletic success to encouragement from his junior high school coach, a guy by the name of Charles Riley. Since Jesse had to support his family, because again, nobody was wealthy, we're talking the height of segregation, that's going to be a theme throughout this, he had to work lots of menial jobs to support the family. Again, 10 kids, 10 mouths to feed. Charles Riley, his coach, allowed him to practice because he was a prodigious talent before school started. Jason, the machine, you understand, you appreciate the power of discipline. But that kind of discipline right there from a young age is the way of the true warrior. And ultimately, it's one of the key emblems of all great champions. He would go on to attend Ohio State University, earning the nickname Buckeye Bullet from his coach, Larry Sidner. He claimed a record 8 individual NCAA championships, 4 in 1935 and 4 in 1936. The year 1936 will always be connected to Jesse. Despite his athletic success, he had to live off campus with fellow African-American athletes. This is 1936, right at the heart, the dirty heart of segregated America. And again, just want to mention this one final time because it is astonishing before we build up to that Olympian efforts. 1935, he recorded 3 world records and tied a 4th in 45 minutes. His record leap in the long jump of 26 feet, 8 and a quarter inches, or 8.13 meters, would stand for a quarter of a century. All that being said, and all that background context, it is, of course, the 1936 Olympic Games in Berlin, at the very height of the Nazi regime, that truly brought Owens to global prominence, dubbed the Hitler Olympics. It was the despot's vision that the Aryan supremacy would be demonstrated to the world. Clearly, Owens didn't get that memo. On August the 3rd, Owens claimed gold at the flagship event, the 100-meter sprint, in a time of 10.3 seconds. The next day, he leapt to his second gold, jumping 8.06 meters in the long jump. August the 5th saw a sprint double with his time of 20.7 seconds, bagging gold in the 200-meter sprint. Then, on August 9th, he achieved his 4th gold at the Games as the USA 4x100-meter relay team set a then-world record of 39.8 seconds. This incredible haul of 4 golds at the halcyon event of all sport, the Olympics, in front of that despot, Hitler, in front of the man who assumed that it was white supremacy ruling through and had that theory ripped asunder physically before his very eyes, showcasing again sport's unique capacity to remind us of the power, forget race, but of the human. That record of 4 at the Olympics would not be equaled until another Hall of Famer, another great athlete, who I actually almost considered for my list. He is an all-time great. Carl Lewis matched Owens' feat like for like in the 1984 LA Games. The Nazi minister, Albert Speer, is documented as saying, "Hitler." I think this is almost a bit of, you know, sometimes we sports pundits love a bit of hyperbole, and I know I'm guilty of it. I think this is its antithesis, a bit of laities or understatement. Hitler was highly annoyed by the marvellous coloured American runner, Jesse Owens. Owens would return to America and be greeted with a Manhattan ticker tape parade. However, sadly, the issues of racism, which still make our modern news, were certainly not localized to Hitler's regime. After the parade was done, Owens was refused entry via the main entrance of the Waldorf Astoria. He was also snubbed by President Roosevelt, who did not offer him an invite to the White House after that glorious Olympics in which, representing America, he showcased America and as what you may call, if you must, the free world's debunking of certain nebulous Nazi theories. In conclusion, though, here, I want to draw attention to another contentious matter that we speak about often here on Verum Sports, and about the fact that sport and business are well-established bedfellows. And sometimes we take a slightly cynical perspective on this, and I get that there is a nefarious side to when sport fuses with business. But the life of Jesse Owens also serves as a reminder of the dangers of hyper-romanticizing earlier eras and amateur times, or certainly less lucrative times from a sporting angle. After the Munich Games, Owens chose to embrace several very lucrative endorsement offers. At the time, track and field was 100% amateur. So, as a consequence, the US athletic officials withdrew Owens' amateur status, meaning he could no longer compete. Of course, the deals, the lucrative sponsors, wanted to have the association of Owens whipping everybody. So all of a sudden, those deals fizzled out. And this, remember, was at the very apex, the very height of the dastardly segregation culture in America, meaning that Owens found it incredibly hard to earn a living here in a, what you might refer to as a quote-unquote regular sense. He worked menial jobs, and this is so tragic. He even had to compete to earn money against race horses. I just don't think you would ever see the likes in our modern era of, for instance, Usain Bolt having to resort to something like that. So times are tough. There's no question about that. But I am absolutely honoured to place Jesse Owens into our Mount Rushmore of sport. He was a giant. And I think he shows us, even in these challenging times, just how much progress has been made. Jason, briefly, your thoughts.
I absolutely love that. And the kind of connection there to the fact that, you know, maybe we discussed it last week, but in many ways, he's an unsung hero there as well, because of the fact that he had to turn to almost ludicrous means of actually sustaining himself and his family. You kind of hear stories about footballers in the 60s and early, you know, if they got a career-ending injury, that they would have to turn to being a plumber and all sorts of things. But as you said, they're at his apex, and the sheer lunacy of the situation that, you know, he couldn't be paid endorsements even though he had more than earned it, and then the kind of terrible situation that was in America at the time and across the world in many places, the fact that, you know, segregation meant that his he couldn't get a job. So I think it's a great shout there. And in terms of it, he was a giant of the sport. That kind of image of at the, as you said, they're dubbed Hitler Olympics, but the story didn't, the Aryan didn't win. It was the person that Hitler hated most, and it was beautiful, and, you know, a small victory over a tyrant there, but one that will live in the annals of history for many, many years. So I really love the Jesse Owens shout, and I think as you explain there carefully as well, he does kind of deserve it above, you know, Lewis and probably Bolt as well, because he was the original, he was the person there, and his records lasted for so many years. So I can't argue with it at all. I think it's a beautiful shout there, and quite a poetic one as well, in terms of the sad end to his career prematurely.
Yeah, like I say, I know I'm guilty of it as everybody, because I'm aware of the certain dark sides of the modern world and the way that sometimes money has a confusing effect when it comes to sport and et cetera, et cetera. But I just wanted to kind of bring that in as a reminder to us all that there's never been a golden era, people. We are just what we are. We're human beings striving to make sense of planet Earth. And what Jesse Owens there, I think his story does remind us, is that if you think about that period of time, that Hitler era, through to the segregation, and I know right now, and I don't want to dwell on it, but you just turn on the news and it is still rife. I don't want to paint the picture that, you know, it's all hunky-dory. It ain't. But as a reminder to us all of the progress that we have made, I find very reassuring. And I just think Jesse Owens, a true giant, goodness knows what he could well have achieved if things had been slightly different, if he had the ability to have longevity. Because at the Olympics at 36, I think he was only 25 years of age. So that record of four, if he'd have gone on to another Olympics and done something equivalent, well, right there, you're going to go into the different stratosphere. But quite frankly, what higher stratosphere can any sportsman have than being enshrined in our Mount Rushmore of sport? And on that, and with that, Jason, it's incumbent upon you now to introduce your first name into the list and the second face in Verum Sport Podcasting's Mount Rushmore of Sport.
Well, just before I start, Tony, I actually had a question here, and I think this is kind of a fun little idea as well. But where do you think we should place this proverbial or this made-up Mount Rushmore of Sport? Do you think there's a place on the globe that is kind of an icon for sport? You know, is it Olympia in Greece, you know, where the Olympics started? Or was there somewhere else that you think that should be the location of our Mount Rushmore of sport?
Do you know what, Jason? That's a wonderbar of a question. If I was going to locate it on planet Earth, I think you could do far worse than have it in Athens, as you say, which, of course, is symbolically the original force of the Olympics. You could make the case maybe for Paris, where the modern Olympics was originally kind of reinitiated. But because I think this is so transcendental, I'm going to suggest that we find somewhere a little more neutral. I say we have it on the moon.
I love that. And maybe instead of the man on the moon, it could be the men on the moon. And you look at your telescope.
There we go.
And that would truly be planetary universal. These are the best ever. Now, the one that I want to put in here, and he's not the winningest, you know, maybe comparable to Jesse Owens, because it's a sad tale with him as well. Even arguably even more so because of the tragedy of his life cut short. But I'm putting in Ayrton Senna, and I think that he's an individual that truly transcends sport as well, because there's a mythology around him. And I think that when you look into him, you look at all his records, his data, the mythology catches up with what actually happened with him. Senna doesn't kind of exceed the narrative. He was taken to us far too early. We didn't see what he was capable of, but there's a few reasons why I think there should be a Mount Rushmore status. Obviously, on the track, fiercely competitive, one of the most individually talented drivers of all time. Three world championships, qualifying speeds kind of displayed with the most pole positions from 1989 to 2006. He held that record. I mean, that is incredible. Again, for somebody whose career was cut so short. He also holds the victory record at Monaco, which a lot of people say is the pinnacle of car racing, and also the fifth most successful driver of all times, again, And I mention it, you know, because he did die so young. What could he have added to that? But it's three factors for me that he was Mr. Rushmore here. He was the most entertaining driver ever. He transcended the sport like no other, and he probably will be eulogised longer than any other. You know, he is the driver's driver. So with the first point, Senna was always committed to the fastest lap, the best racer on the track, sometimes to his detriment. We kind of mentioned it before. Monaco, he cost himself quite badly in many occasions. But he also transcended the sport like no other because he worked for the others in his sport. You know, on the racetrack, he was really competitive, but he had that human side. We've seen the videos of him running out to save a fellow racing driver because he realised that, yes, you can lose life and limb in a race, but it's not worth it, and you do have to think of others. And sadly, in many ways, he was martyred in many ways to actually create the safety that we see in the sport today, which he campaigned for so long for. And on the final point, I think that he'll be eulogised for any longer because of that entertainment, but also from being taken from us so young. He will be forever young. We never got to see him grow old. And thus, he is young Senna, always at the top. So I think as well that the sadness for me is what we discussed before with Michael Schumacher going to Ferrari. He was going to Ferrari first, and there's a lot there. But I think with the Senna situation, I think that he has to be on Rushmore for sport because sport is about entertainment, and he is the most entertaining driver ever. So you have to put the most entertaining people up there, and Senna just takes it for me.
Love that. Really great case. And I tell you what, it's one of those, isn't it? It's almost like in the world of entertainment. Madonna, just one name, you know? Michael Jackson, Michael. You know, Elvis Presley, Elvis, he was, is, and will forever be Senna. I think, you know, it's that when you achieve that one name association, you've done something quite well at whatever you're good at.
No, I totally agree. And I think when you mention F1, you know, you do think of Schumacher, the winningest, but the fact that he's not the winningest of all time, as you'd say there, Tony, a really great, like, I'd call it Tonyism, but the fact that he isn't the most successful driver of all time, but he's still, in reverent tones, it's still argued that he is the best of all time. I think that, like you said there, the one word Senna, you just associate it with F1. And so many drivers, even now, Lewis Hamilton kind of says, he was my inspiration. It's kind of like in the world of cooking, you'd say the chef. Who did all the chefs learn? And you'd say he's the original, he's the origins of great driving. So I think that there's no kind of argument in my mind. I respect Schumacher so much. I love Hamilton. And I think he will probably get Schumacher's record and exceed it. But even then, I don't think that he's Rushmore status because I don't think he transcends the sport enough for me in that sense because he's a bit too Marmite as well, I'd say, Hamilton and Schumacher. A lot of people kind of say Schumacher, I don't believe it, but was a cheat. And we kind of saw that he got banned a few times. Hamilton, Marmite, again, a lot of people say best car. But Senna quite often came out on top, not in the best car, in terrible condition. So Senna, for me, Mount Rushmore of sport, and he's got to be up there. With your pick of Jesse Owens, and who else is going to be joining them up there, carved into the moon face of our Mount Rushmore.
Awesome stuff. I really like that Senna shout. And as you say, the most successes ever at Monaco. I want to say it was six. That number six has come up again because I've used it before. There were, of course, six contenders for the BBC Sports Personality of the Century. But the walkaway winner, the man who walks into anybody's Mount Rushmore of sports. To be honest, this is such a great, challenging debate. But if you want to debate this one with me, I don't really want to know you. I think Muhammad Ali walks into any Mount Rushmore of sports. And I tell you what, I'm not making the case here tonight, but there's a case to be made that he's in contention, in the debate at least, for for the Mount Rushmore of all-time great human beings, irrespective of one's art, one's craft, one's gift, one's humanitarianism, whatever category. He is in the debate. I'll simply begin my case with that, saying that he is, in my opinion, one of the most important, one of the most influential, his favorite word, one of the greatest human beings who ever graced our planet. He oozed greatness. And after becoming the youngest heavyweight champion of the world at age 22, it took until Mike Tyson many years later to even break that record. That stood many a while. This was the first of three heavyweight title reigns. He forced the fearsome Sonny Liston to stay on his stool after round six. Ali proclaimed himself, "I am the greatest. I shook up the world. I am the greatest." And who could deny it? But in truth, this typical, impassioned statement was simply the flowering of a long-established seed. Ali observed, "I am the greatest. I said that even before I knew I was." Born Cassius Marcellus Clay Jr. into a relatively middle-class background in Louisville, an all-black area, again, in still segregated America, he was the son of Cassius Clay Sr. and Odessa Grady Clay. Like all great superhero stories, there has to be that origin moment. And if you want to buy into the mythos of Ali, and why not? Let's not be cynical. Let's accept that this is indeed categorically true. It must be. He said it was so. The legend of Ali begins when, for his 12th birthday, Ali, then still, of course, Clay Jr., received a red Schwinn Corvette bike. He truly adored this bike, riding it each and every day, everywhere he went. One day, after going to a shop, he was enraged to discover someone had stolen this precious gift. He went to the police station to report the incident, declaring, "I want to whoop the person who stole my bike." The officer who filed this report, history-defining moment, was Joe E. Martin, who, as luck would have it, serendipity perhaps, he ran the local boxing club. According to this legend, he replied to the young, impassioned Ali, "Well, son, if you're going to get into a fight with a guy who stole your bike, you better learn to fight." Martin is often attributed with being Ali's primary trainer in these formative years. The actual reality is the person who taught Ali the art of boxing was Fred Stoner from the Grace Community Center. Talking about Stoner years later, Ali's quoted as saying, "He taught me all I knew." Not a bad little slice of history there. Another legend regarding Ali Clay at the time, in his formative years, was that he encouraged the kids in the neighborhood to throw rocks at him, melding the supreme evasive techniques that were his signature in his early stratospheric career. Ali simply had the boxing bug. He would go on to become a six-time Kentucky Golden Glove winner, and by 1959 was widely recognized as the best amateur boxer in the world. A point proven just 1 year later. We're talking Olympics. We're talking how that is indeed right up there, maybe indeed the most significant sporting event in the world. Well, representing the USA, as he was then, Cassius Clay bagged gold in Rome. Already, the young Ali's wit and charisma, allied to immense pugilistic skill, led many of the world's elite athletes to dub him, and I love this, Mayor of the Olympic Village. I mentioned in a previous podcast in which we talked about great sports documentaries. Do check that out, people. It's a great chat. A little bit about the Ali style. I want to just go into a little bit more detail because as much as he's transcendent, let's not forget that this is the Mount Rushmore of sport. And we do have to frame his sporting prowess. Stylistically, it's fair to say, and I mean in the best possible sense of this word, he was a freak. Before Ali, heavyweights would tend to hold their hands beside their head and would basically plod forwards, looking to hold the center of the ring, almost, if you could imagine, Frankenstein-style approach to boxing. Ali ripped apart the rule book, arms down, and of course, that iconic Ali Shuffle. Ali's jab was simply Piston-esque. Prior to Ali, the jab was more of a probing tool to create gaps for a much more substantial punch. By contrast, the velocity and also the array, the perplexing array of angles that he utilized this punch, converted a jab into a brutal and scintillating weapon. Many experts consider that Ali had at least 15 varieties of jab. Now, purists will have us believe that the left hook should never be employed as a lead punch. Jason, I'm sure in your boxing escapades, you've been explained that, and I'm sure you appreciate the dangers of it. Leaves a fighter just open to a right cross. Ali threw that left lead with such rare defensive gifts that he was just comfortable to do this. And not only would he do it, he wouldn't utilize it just as a singular punch, but he'd throw that left lead in flurries. In a similar way, one, according to the textbook, should not lead with the right cross. But again, Ali did that with such pace, it could connect more rapidly than most fighters' jabs. I want to talk about discipline. It's a watchword. It's synonymous. Indeed, it's the signature of all great people and truly all great sports stars. And anybody walking into our Mount Rushmore sport oozes discipline. Love these quotes. Ali is quoted as saying, "The fight is won or lost far away from witnesses, behind the lines, in the gym and out on the road, long before I dance under those lights." Great quote. But it's in context, I think, even more critical when you combine it with this one, that discipline is sometimes something that even the greats don't enjoy, but they embrace. Ali goes on to say, "I hated every minute of training, but I said, don't quit. Suffer now." I'll repeat that. "Suffer now and live the rest of your life as a champion." The greats always know how to surround themselves with greats. Ali will always be connected to his phenomenal Hall of Fame trainer, Angelo Dundee, who was in his corner for all bar the very first Ali fight. He was the perfect coach for Ali, and there's one simple reason why. He quite simply let Ali be Ali. He didn't try to tweak his techniques and the quirks in the techniques and his style that I've mentioned. He simply understood that he was working with a rare, unique, and special individual. So as well as this startling technique, Ali understood the showmanship, the business, and I would argue, maybe more critically than all of the above, the psychology of the sport of kings, all of which were required when aged just 22. He challenged the behemoth Sonny Liston for the heavyweight title in 1964. Before this, in his last two fights, Liston had pulverized Hall of Famer Floyd Patterson. Again, at this stage in his career, in his life, Ali was still known as Cassius Clay, the Louisville Lip. At the weigh-in, he behaved so hysterically that the examining doctor described him as emotionally unbalanced, scared to death. But all his medical readings registered normal. Ali would explain, "I wanted Liston to know I was crazy. Only a fool isn't scared of a crazy man." So that's overplaying that psychology. And don't get me wrong, he was 22, still very a callow youth. Only 19 fights into a pro career against a man who had gangster connections, is potentially literally a killer, and a man who had in the ring metaphorically killed some bona fide greats. It was a step up. I'm sure, no doubt about it, Ali was terrified, but he turned that deficit into a supreme psychological advantage by amplifying it, by playing it up, and that is the class of the man. It's the mind as well as the matter that matters most. In the fight, the young talent was boxing proverbial rings around the aging Liston before another iconic, history-defining moment occurred. At the end of the fourth, Ali found himself partially blinded. According to boxing folklore, this was actually caused by Liston rubbing liniment or a coagulant into Clay's eyes. Terrified, Ali or Clay wanted to quit. Again, this is where Dundee steps up. This is where that could have been it. It could have been no Muhammad Ali, no Mount Rushmore Pace, no Icon. Could have been over then. But again, Dundee, Angelo Dundee, the trainer, stepped up to the plate. He said simply, "Dance, boy, dance. Get through this round and you've got him." Thankfully, Clay heeded those words, and a deflated Liston couldn't get out of his stall for round seven. The mission accomplished. The world indeed had been shaken up, and Ali became the youngest heavyweight champ of the world at that time. Now, all great people's lives are not perfect. Ali's life will always be a controversial one. And a few days later, as I say, known as Cassius Clay Jr., that was his, what he referred to as his slave name, confirmed one of the worst kept secrets in all of sports. And he announced publicly that he was a member of the very controversial Nation of Islam. And their leader, Elijah Muhammad, actually conferred on him the name that we all know and love, Muhammad Ali. Now, there are so many controversial aspects to this very separatist religion, and it bears such little connection to any type of Islamic faith. I won't dwell on it at this time, but I think personally, Ali himself sums up his own faith best when speaking to a truly great journalist and writer, Davis Miller, who chronicled the Ali life. It's brilliant, their connection. And I just think this is truly beautiful. Ali states, "The only religion that matters is the real religion, love." It was Ali's commitment to his faith, though, that connected him as a man apart, a man bigger than sport and greater than art. He took a firm stance and refused conscription into the army to fight in the Vietnam War. There is, of course, another iconic Ali quote in which he said, "I ain't got no quarrel with no Viet Cong." When officially he refused the draft on April 27th, 1967, almost instantaneously, every boxing commission stripped him of his title. He had his passport and boxing license revoked, in much the same way as Owens 30 years before this. The consequence of that was he simply could not make a living anywhere else, and he could not box. Now, there was so much politics here. Again, I don't want to go into too much on it. What I will add, tragically, from a pure sporting angle, fight fans were deprived, as a consequence of this, the prime athletic years of his career. And I will say this much. Let's not forget, if he had gone out to Vietnam, it almost certainly would really have been there to entertain the troops, in much the same way as Bob Hope, Elvis Presley, and a myriad of other stars of that era did just that. I'm not saying it would have been an easy ride, but it would have been a smoother one. But he remained steadfast in his faith and his stance. And whilst he alienated many Americans, at that moment, at that time, he transcended his time and space and sport itself, becoming an icon to Black America and beloved across the globe. In a previous podcast, and do check out the review of the Best Sporting Docs podcast, guys. I know you've already heard it, but check it out. It's a great one. I've already eulogized about the famous October 1974 Rumble in the Jungle, so I won't elaborate at this time, but I'll just simply reference it to highlight the poetic qualities to this man's amazing life. A full 10 years after becoming the youngest champ, age 22, he got his second of three title reigns against another devastating puncher in George Foreman, a fight witnessed by 1 billion people around the globe. That's all I'm going to say about the Rumble in Jungle, but do check it out. If you haven't seen it, you can find it online. It is sensational. Instead, I just briefly want to highlight the epic trilogy he shared with Joe Frazier, which illustrates both the absolute best and indeed the worst of Ali. Like all great sports stars, Ali's story is magnified with tremendous rivalries. An era packed with drama was graced with a heavyweight division rich in talent. For all eternity, the name of Joe Frazier will be enshrined alongside Ali's own. I've referenced Ali's prowess as a master of psychological warfare, but in their first bout, the fight of the century, as Frazier was the unbeaten champ against Ali, also literally, technically unbeaten, because he was coming back after a 3.5 year ban following the controversy over his stance with Vietnam. But this would witness Ali take this psychological assault to, I would argue, vicious levels, taunting the champ, dubbing him an Uncle Tom, and constantly maligning his appearance. The fight itself was intense, with so much of his natural speed eroded after 3 years out, 3.5 years. Ali relied on bravery, and this was encapsulated when he was dealt a fearsome left hook, which actually knocked him down in the last of the scheduled, and it was then. Nowadays, it's 12 rounds. We all know that. In this era, 15 rounds. This would have KO'd many an opponent. But Ali actually got off the canvas after 2 seconds. He beat the count, but lost the fight unanimously on the judges' cards. A much fresh Ali then would cruise later to a points win in their second fight. Their third clash is enshrined in boxing and indeed sporting folklore. It's in the debate for one of the greatest fights of all time, and it's aptly named the Thriller in Manila from October 1975. So these two aging warriors collide for the dead heat in this three epic wave dance. They would collide in 100 Fahrenheit conditions with humidity levels off the charts. If the temperature was hot, the action in the ring was even hotter. 14 rounds of what could only be described as beautiful violence. Frazier's revered corner man, to preserve his fighter's longer-term health, cut his man's glove before that 15th and final round, meaning Ali won by TKO. As usual, the great man summarized it way better than I can. Going through that fight was the next thing to die in, Ali said. Ali would lose his title to an unfancy Leon Spinks in 78, a fight in which his usual assiduous preparation was hardly to the fore. He would avenge the loss in front of 70,000 of his hometown fans at the Superdome, New Orleans. This made him the only three-time heavyweight champ, a record which still stands today. He announced his retirement after this fight, and I've previously said, and I don't want to reaffirm, but I really wish in many ways he'd done so after the much earlier Rumble in the Jungle. But the culture, the allure of the spotlight, plus also, sadly, almost like Jesse Owens to a different degree, financial needs forced Ali to continue on before a terribly ignominious loss to Larry Holmes, described by Sylvester Stallone, who was at ringside, as like watching an autopsy of a man who is still alive. Ali was officially diagnosed with Parkinson's disease in 1984, having absorbed over 200,000 shots in his career. He remained beloved around the world, doing remarkable humanitarian aid, negotiating with dictators, and achieving feats presidents could not, by freeing American prisoners. His lighting of the Olympic torch at the Atlanta Games 1996 served again as a reminder of the sheer will, passion, and quality of this history-defining figure. Ali would pass away on June the 3rd, 2016, with the entire world mourning. But Ali will always remain in our hearts, minds, and thoughts an immortal amongst men. I'm going to conclude briefly by summarizing some of his sporting achievements and then end by giving the last word to the greatest. Ali remains the only three-time heavyweight champ. His record of 21 victories at world title level, winning 14 unified title fights, stood for 35 years. He's the only boxer named Ring Magazine Fighter of the Year 6 times, voted greatest athlete of the century by Sports Illustrated, and he claimed more votes than all the other worthy 5 nominees in the many times referenced BBC Sports Personality of the Century. Truly a hero, truly a legend, but I'm going to leave it to Ali to summarize. I'll tell you how I'd like to be remembered: as a black man who won the heavyweight title, who was humorous and treated everyone right, as a man who never looked down on those who looked up to him, a man who stood for freedom, justice and equality. I wouldn't even mind if folks forgot how pretty I was.
I just love that. And I think your summary there at the end, just letting Ali speak, because at the end of the day, he was the best kind of summariser of his own talents. You know, you could literally write a whole book, and I'm sure many have, of his amazing quotes. I think the problem with Ali was we both wanted to talk about him. He is the, I think, bona fide best sports person of all time. I think in terms of Mount Rushmore, I know they're all the same size, but if we could make him just an eensy bit bigger, just to show that he is the giant that he is, I think that would be fair, because he's somebody that transcends sport, history. He just does it all. And, you know, we don't want to talk too much politics here because we are all about sport, but he just did everything. And he showed that nothing was impossible. And again, like you said with Jesse Owens, it was a sad story because in many ways he was undervalued, maybe by those in his own country and his peers. And after his retirement, I think he gained even more kind of notoriety, but also respect that maybe he didn't have during his career. I don't think words can do Ali justice, but I think you did a fantastic job there, Tony, just to encapsulate and give a slice of his absolute genius there. I don't think I can add any more.
I'm sure everybody listening does have opinions on Ali, though, and we'd love to hear them. Tweet at Verulam Sport. Again, I'm sure you've got opinions on Mount Rushmore Sports with 3 out of 4. There can be only one more. Jason, who completes the picture?
Well, now this one is, I think, you know, football is the biggest sport in the world. It's the most observed, I think the most followed. And in many ways, kind of like Muhammad Ali, you know, it's a very unifying sport as well. It kind of crosses political barriers. It can often break down political barriers. And so this choice of the Mount Rushmore choice of the footballer to go on here was very, very difficult. And I'm sure we're going to debate my choice in terms of who I actually chose at the end, because there are many names to throw into the ring. But in terms, I'm going a little bit different from kind of Senna here, because I'm going with who I think is the greatest kind of sports person and footballer of all time, in terms of just his sheer maybe physique and machine-like abilities, because I'm going with the sheer machine, Cristiano Ronaldo. At age 35, he is not slowing up. He's often compared to his younger peers, and kind of medically speaking, he actually has still a body of a 20-year-old. Now, what I love about Ronaldo, so many records to his name, but I think it's also his tactical kind of brilliance to adapt his play style with his aging body. So when he started out at Sporting Lisbon, he was a master of the tricks, kind of cutting in from the wing and scoring fantastic goals. But he was all about his pace. At Man United, he was kind of a rough diamond that Ferguson really moulded into somebody spectacular. And then he got that Premier League record season. He matched the most of a 38 Premier League game season in terms of goal scoring, which was actually beaten by Mo Salah recently, another fantastic winger. But he then moved to Real Madrid, and I think his Man United days definitely put him in history books. But what he achieved at Real Madrid has put him in my kind of Mount Rushmore there. He's won 5 Champions League, which I think is the pinnacle of European, club football. Unfortunately, in terms of an international sense, he won't be as successful because his Portugal team, whilst blessed with talent, I don't think it's as kind of talented as other teams. So in terms of club sport, I think he undoubtedly lifted Real Madrid. And what I would say as well, with those 5 Champions Leagues, he won it at 2 different clubs, Manchester United and then Real Madrid. And then he's also won the league in 3 different countries. Now, a lot of people will say, you know, when I started off, Messi. And I think it's kind of a redundant argument to kind of say who's better out of the two. But what I'm speaking about, as a pure physical specimen, he has to be considered the greatest because he's physically the best in terms of his height, his strength, his speed, and his shooting ability. I think if you were to go into a lab and have a test tube baby of the perfect footballer, you'd pick Ronaldo for all his attributes. Skillfully, maybe Messi beats him, but that's an argument for another time. What also is there is the longevity of his career. He's just smashed that amazing 1,000 appearance kind of goal. He's the 18th for all time appearances in football now. And what I love as well is he's almost got a goal to every appearance there is. And in terms of goal contributions, I think he's got more than his actual appearances. It's obscene, his numbers. It's crazy. And he's Real Madrid's highest goal scorer of all time, which is not something to be sniffed at. The club is one of the kind of embodiments of sporting success. But what I would also say, and I feel a little bit dirty bringing this up, but we do have to kind of acknowledge it. He is a commercial success. We have to talk about how he is a brand. And I talk about how shares in Juventus actually doubled in the first few months that they bought Cristiano Ronaldo. But he's the most followed sports person online. I'd argue the most recognisable footballer in the world. And in 2010 to 2019, he earned the second most amount of money to any sports person in the world, coming second only to Mr. Money himself, Floyd Mayweather, who, you know, he just generates money just from clicking his fingers. He's amazing. But in terms of it, Ronaldo is a commercial success as well. And I think the fact that he's the most followed, you know, the most shirts bought, all those kind of data proves to me that he has to be on the Mount Rushmore sport because everybody, I would say, in the world, either knows of Ronaldo or knows somebody that knows Ronaldo. You go to places like Afghanistan, Iraq, even war-torn countries, you know, where there's famine, there's poverty. Ronaldo is a symbol there. And you see, you know, young children wearing his name on the back of the shirt. And he's also a symbol of hope for a lot of these people. I would like to move on also. A little bit like Senna, he kind of transcends sport in many ways. He doesn't drink because of his father's alcoholism, and he's a real giver of, philanthropy. He's a very charitable person, and he also doesn't have a tattoo on his body so that he can give blood, which I think is an amazing story. He's a very dedicated person, and a lot of kind of his teammates will agree with that. Patrice Evra and others have kind of said Ronaldo would play a game and then he'd invite them over. He'd say, come over, we'll have some food. But that food was also coupled with another post-game training session. He just doesn't stop. He knows his body. And I really like studying him as well. As I said at the start, he's adapted his tactics, but also his diet and the way he trains. Because he is 35 now. He said he wants to play till 40. I think he can probably keep up there at the top until 40. Because he is so dedicated to sport, and I think that in terms of football, he is the embodiment of success, he's the embodiment of entertainment, and he is probably one of the best, most winning players of all time. So I think in terms of all three, he has to be on a Mount Rushmore of football and sport, because there's not many that compare to him.
Jason, tell you what, can't fault your rationale. I love the case you've made. I think it's a very compelling one indeed. I'm just going to say this, though, super quickly. First of all, I want to heap praise on the man. As you say, what a career. And that intelligence to recognise the need to change the game. We mentioned discipline. It's been to the fore throughout all of the people in this list. Of course it is. They're great. But his discipline, anybody who's seen him on Instagram, it's almost astonishing, his commitment to his regimen. And I just have mega respect accordingly. For me, there isn't a debate. He and Messi are era-defining players and would be certainly worthy of a spot, either or, and that's a matter of opinion, on the Mount Rushmore of football. No questions about it. As to whether he deserves the representative of football on our Mount Rushmore, that is, I think, subject to debate. Quickly, I will add, though, again, I think the case for Ronaldo has been amplified by the fact that he has done it across multiple countries, which I think is to his credit, as you said brilliantly, but also at the international level. Let's not forget, Portugal got their first trophy really inspired by their all-time top scorer. I think he's got 99 international goals. So he is a winner at the elite of the elite level. So therefore, puts you in the mix. I'm going to personally say that I suspect my own attitude to Ronaldo, who I insert tongue firmly into cheek, sometimes consider all punchable face, because I simply can't ever quite forgive him for that cheeky wink that got Rooney sent off in the, I want to say, the 2006 Germany World Cup. So that's my personal prejudice. I'm throwing it out there. And so perhaps that tarnishes my own opinion on the man, respecting him massively as I do. But I'm going to say this much to you. He is a brand, but he's also living in the era of branding. I still suspect that most people on planet Earth would recognize the face of Pelé. And for me, Pelé is almost I think maybe in terms of sport, the only human being who can look Ali in the eyes and have a we're almost equivalents type of a conversation, in my humble opinion. I mean, officially 650 goals in 694 league games. Unofficially, he's actually in the Guinness Book of Records. With 1,281 goals, inclusive of friendlies, in 1,363 games. Three-time World Cup winner. Again, there we are talking, if Olympics is the granddaddy of all sports, the World Cup is the granddaddy of football. And I respect that it's not really fair to compare, because Portugal are not Brazil. You think of the names of that Brazilian team in the 70s, but his career, talking longevity, was astronomical. When you think that he made his debut for Brazil age 16, way back in the late 50s, and carried on through five different World Cups, truly, truly astonishing. But it's that association, that humanity. And again, don't get me wrong, I massively respect Ronaldo's philanthropy, but there is something just unique about that smile of Pelé that instantaneously makes you want to connect with him. I've never had the privilege of his company. I pray one day I will before it's all said and done. But he just strikes all of us as a man of the world, a man of the people. And for me, Pelé is the face, the poster boy of football, and will be until somebody takes that mantle. Don't debate at all that Ronaldo is an era definer. I recognize his transcendental qualities, but I don't think he has that quite universal pan transcendence of a Pelé. And almost to rest my case, I'm going to use your good friend, a man who I know inspires you, Johan Cruyff. who states, Pelé must be the only footballer who surpasses the boundaries of logic. Cruyff's words, not mine. I would have him, Pelé, as my face of football. But again, I know you've got opinions. Do tweet them in. Tweet at Verulam Sport. Pelé versus Ronaldo, your take. Overall, who have we missed? Jonah Lomu doesn't get in contention. Jack Nicklaus, not in the mix. Of course, we haven't even spoke about tennis whatsoever. Federer, the winningest. So many greats in that sport. McEnroe and so many others. Who is your all-time Mount Rushmore? Four to play with across all sports. Tweet us at Verulam Sport. We're just coming back, Jason. I kind of made the case for Pelé. Could you feel yourself swayed? Are you sticking ardently to Ronaldo as your man in our Mount Rushmore?
I mean, at the end of the day, I do get Pelé, and he was probably my second choice. I think Maradona comes third, but in terms of what you would kind of say, he probably in the English sphere is probably equally punchable, Maradona, because of the hand of God and everything. But with Pelé, I think in recent years, he's kind of gone to the extent that's a little bit spoiled his legacy, where he's over-embellished his goal-scoring antics. You know, he obviously...
It is enshrined in the Guinness Book of Records, who obviously do have to do their due diligence.
Yes, I don't mean that, but I mean him actually kind of telling stories about he scored 10 in this game and 11 in this, and in utterly... unkind of checkable circumstances, and it, in many kind of discussions in the football community, it's almost become like a meme and a parody, which is a real shame, because obviously Pelé should be respected, and like you said there, he is a little bit like Ali. You know, you see pictures with him with Putin and kind of having discussions with presidents and people like that. Just for me, yes, Pelé is Mr. World Cup, which is the pinnacle of football, three times, I think the most ever for an individual player, and the fact that he started at age 16 there is crazy. But I don't think I'd change my opinion, because I think Ronaldo is, as I said, the embodiment of everything that a footballer should and could possibly be. Kind of along the lines of what you said with Ali, Ronaldo is a pure freak. And if I was to choose between the two in terms of my all-time greatest team, I would go for Ronaldo in terms of just his sheer freakish abilities. So that's kind of my measure. If I was going to choose one of them for the most entertainment, but also the best kind of ability, I would still have to pick Ronaldo. But Pelé comes in a close second, and I think he does transcend the sport. But I think Ronaldo, in my opinion, and as always, we invite people to kind of argue with me on Twitter, social media. You can email in as well, sport at Radio Verulam. You can tell Tony, Jason is very wrong, and that Ronaldo does not transcend the sport. But I just think he does now. And I think that him and Messi are the two new stalwarts, the new symbols of football, which will last for, I don't know how long, many, many years, until we see two other people, or even just one individual that just breaks record after record after record. And they've got so many to their names, I don't know who can.
But I tell you what, that's what sport does, though, doesn't it? It inspires the next generation. It raises the bar, and then the human nature says, you've set that bar, I'm going to smash it. That's why we love it. And we love having these conversations. It's been a challenge tonight, but it's been a great fun. As always, I want to say a massive thank you to the machine, Jason McKenna, raising a glass to your awesome work. I want to thank you massively for listening. I want to invite you, as always, to keep involved and tweet at Verulam Sport, because I simply know you've got your opinions on this one, and indeed anything to do with sport. Stay tuned, because we've got a great chat with the wonderful Stuart Clark from Be Military Fit coming up, and make sure you're with us next week for yet more compelling debates. For now, keep well, keep safe. Thank you for listening.